Okay, let's get started. We're in Perek of Megillat Esther. We're in Pasuk Dalet. We have, the Gezer has been sent out. Esther has approached Ahasuerus. And what is going to happen next? V'tomer Esther, imam ha-melech tov, yavo ha-melech v'haman hayom al-hamishta asher asiti lo. And last week, we talked about a number of, if everyone just doesn't mind, please, mute
yeah,
themselves.
I'll do it. I'll take care of it. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you, Michelle. Last week, we talked about a whole slew of explanations in the Gemara of the strategy of why Esther decided to invite Haman and Ahasuerus both to a party as her way to reach them, to convince them to cancel the Gezerah and to catch Haman. So we have behind us all her different ideas of how to do this strategically, and here she's inviting them to this party. And I'll be honest, starting the sheer funny, because I don't recall the source where I saw this, but you may notice that in Pasuk Gimel, the king says to Esther, Malach Esther Amaka, and then he says, Umava Kashatef al Khatia Machlut Vitinatin Mach. And he says, the reason is for this extra expression of Malach is because when she went in to the palace, he noticed that there was something strange about her and that she looked a little off. She had been fasting, she was very distressed, and he noticed that something was wrong. So first he says, Malach, and then he says, what do you want? So Esther here in Pasuk Zalad invites him and Haman to this party. And Pasuk Hey, v'yomer ha-melech maharu et Haman l'dvar Esther, v'yavo ha-melech v'haman el ha-mishta asher asa Esther. So Ahasuerus didn't really have this idea to go to the party, but he's supposed to invite Haman too, so he describes it as dvar Esther. And interestingly, just as previously, we had Mordechai the Tzaddik, who used to be giving the orders, listening to Esther's orders. Now we have Ahasuerus the king, who usually gives the orders, giving along Esther's orders as well. So Esther is even kind of promoted, in a sense, to an even more important position and a more active and powerful position here. And the king says, okay, whatever she says, once again already is like total hashgacha, clearly, that he's saying this, and go quickly get Haman ready. And Haman and Ahasuerus went to this party that Esther prepared. So the king says to Esther, Mashi lotech v'nasing lach. So now he doesn't say Malach Esther because there's no concern in how she appears, even though, interestingly, it's actually the third day of the fast. We had made a calendar previously where we tracked the different days of our three-day fast, and the second day was the day she approached the king, and the third day was actually the day of the first party. But here, it's a Mishayayin, it's a wine party. The king, we know, loves parties, so he's all distracted, he's all involved in this party, which was part of her strategy. And so he's not paying attention to how she looks anymore. And instead, he does remember, however, that there was something that she wanted to ask, and he's smart enough to know, like, this couldn't be the main purpose of Esther's approaching me, you know, unannounced and uncalled for. There must be something else she wants besides to invite me to a party, or else, you know, it doesn't seem like such a large, serious thing that she should risk her life for it. So he says, so what do you want? He says it again. Vatan Esther Vatomer. Esther answers, She'elati u'bakashati. She says, yes, I do have a request, and here it is. As we know, she doesn't make her request right away. Instead, she invites him to another party. So the question is, why didn't she just invite them right away? Why didn't she not invite them? Why didn't she just say her line right away? Why didn't she just accuse Haman and get things going? What's the point of the second party? So when we have the shiur, for those who are new, when we have the shiur in person, we really enjoy the back and forth and thoughtful discussion for everyone to really think what, you know, contribute what they think and not just what I have to say. So I invite you to unmute yourself if you have something to share, a thought of why possibly, what, you know, we read this every year in Purim. You would think it's obvious question, but what really is answer? Why didn't she just say it at the first party? Anyone ever think of this question before? Good question, right? It's just part of the story. We all know it. Okay? Or maybe everyone's just too shy to undo their mute. I don't know. But either way, so we have a very good question. There's a commentary called Emmanuel of Rome, who says something beautiful, and then it's built upon more by the Ibn Ezra. And Emmanuel of Rome says as follows. He says, she wasn't ready. We must just mention, this was the third day of the fast, and it was a very serious time, and she was still very much in serious mode. Imagine the scene, right? Ahasuerus and Haman are sitting there at this party, and they're eating, and they're having a great time, and the Maharal points out that Esther wasn't eating anything at this party. This was her third day of her fast. She was just kind of serving things. Perhaps Haman was almost a foil so that Ahasuerus should be eating and drinking with someone so that he wouldn't notice that Esther herself actually wasn't eating. And they were enjoying themselves, and she was just kind of doing her thing. And she sensed in herself that there's something wasn't quite right yet, that it wasn't a time. It wasn't a time for the Yeshua to come. Something in the alignment of Hashem's arrangement of things was not ready to pour out the gates of Rachamim to Am Yisrael and save Am Yisrael with Yeshua at that moment. She sensed inside of herself, it's not right. This is not good. This is not the moment of the Yeshua here. She knew that it just wasn't right. And so instead, at that moment, she made this second decision. And again, when we had spoken last week about the 12 different explanations of her strategy, why she planned to have a party, most of them, or many of them, weren't exact. They weren't exactly explaining what Esther planned to do. It was more why she planned to have a party, because the downfall of the enemy when they eat and drink and different things like that. And it's not so clear if Esther knew exactly what her next move was going to be or not. And here we see, according to the commentary, that she actually may not have known what her next step was. But at that moment, she was relying on her intuition and her connection to Hashem and Hashgacha Pratis to tell her if it was the right moment or not. And in fact, he says, she felt that it was not the right moment. The full 3 days of fasting were not over yet, and things were not in the right light of Rachamim yet. And so she said to herself, you know what? It's not time. Let's complete the 3 days of fasting, and we'll try again tomorrow. And maybe after Am Yisrael has fasted for 3 full days, then there'll be enough zechuyos that it's the time for the Yeshua, and that'll be the time to make my bakashaseh to Ahasuerus. And so the Ibn Ezra, in fact, is what she did. And on the second day, something was different. Who can think, again, I invite you to participate, open your microphone if you have some idea, why should the second day have been any different? Think of the story of the Purim story. What was different at the second party? So as we're going to see, the night after the first party, in the very next parak we'll do next week, is the night after the first party is when Haman came to Ahasuerus in the middle of the night, and we have the whole turnaround beginning, clearly, where Mordechai ends up wearing the cleanly clothing, and Haman walks him through the streets, right? And this is this big celebration. What's the big celebration? Why are we so excited when we read that part of the Megillah? That all of a sudden Mordechai is wearing the clothing of the king. Yeah, that's nice, but there's still a Gezeira and there's still a Haman, and why does that solve anything? Just because he's wearing the king's clothing through the streets? Anyone ever think of that question before on Purim when reading Megillah, right? It seems like it's a good omen, but what did it actually do in the story? A good omen makes us happy, but it's only worth something if it does something, right? Feel-good moments are only worth something if they contribute to something. Otherwise, it's just blank inspiration that's empty. Good lesson for life. So it says, Ibn Ezra, it wasn't empty. It wasn't just a feel-good moment for Am Yisrael to make them feel better. In fact, it did contribute something. And what it did was, that gave Esther her chush inside herself. After she had seen and known of Mordechai going through the streets with this honor, all of a sudden, seemingly out of nowhere, right, treated like a king, and Haman himself walking him through the streets as the servant form, the servant's position, Esther said, oh, that's my Ashkacha Pratis. That's my chush. I know that something is different now. Obviously, apparently, in Shemayim, the tables have turned, and Hashem's Rachamim is now looking down on us. And now, I can make my request, because now Hashem is looking at Am Yisrael in a positive way, and now there's an opening for the Yeshua to come. So this is an opportune time. And this is why she waited until the second party. We have Pasuk Chet. She invited him to the second party. So the first party ended happy. This is, there was a party, there's going to be another party, and Esther planned it this way because she actually didn't know what was going to happen next, and because she didn't have it all planned out. And I think that this is a really interesting perspective for us to understand, because on one hand, we often view Esther as the mastermind of the Heshavos part of the Purim story, and in a way she is. And we know from the beginning, also in previous classes, we talked about how as soon as Mordechai started appearing in sackcloth, she was like, something is going on, I must find out. And she was very strategic in how she sent out her messenger, Hatach, to gather information to know what's going on, and she was strategic in the way she approached the king, and how she organized Am Yisrael to fast and disattach themselves from Gashmius when she ascertained that part of their problem and the sin that deserved the punishment was Gashmius. She was very strategic through this whole thing. But she didn't know all the answers. She didn't know all the answers. She planned it as much as she could. She used her logic. She understood Ahasuerus was a person who loved parties, who loved Gashmius, who loved wine. You know, she put it in a context that would probably be most conducive to him liking what she had to say and listening to what she had to say. But she didn't really know what she was going to say. She didn't really have the final piece of the puzzle put in place and everything solved to the T of exactly a scheme and a plan. She was relying on Hashem. After a certain point of her strategy, it was a chush, and it was a connection to Hashem, Vashgacha Pratis. And so here, she says that, okay, I have to let go, I'm going to feel, I'm going to think. Yes, there's the mind, there's the logic, there's the strategy, but then after a certain point, we let go. And after a certain point, it's Hashem. And it's Hashgacha, and I can't do everything, and I'm not in charge of everything, says Esther. It's just Mina Shemayim, and she senses it. She is connected enough. We know that when she went in to the Ahasuerus' palace, also we studied last week, that there was a certain Ruach HaKodesh that came over her. She was had a very strong connection to the Shekhinah, to Hashem. After her effort, her revolution to go get the whole nation to do tshuva, at that point, she was able to develop a very, very strong internal connection to Hashem. And so not only was she using her human mind and strategy, but she had something deeper going on and something higher going on. And this is very important for us mortals over here, who we try our best in this world, we use our strategy, we use our mind, we plan out as best as we can, and after a certain point we let go and we let Hashem put himself in the picture. And I've thrown in a few references to coronavirus in recent weeks because it's highly relevant to all of us. And I'll bring it again now because I'll tell you honestly, the last few weeks, I like to look for Hashem in the Torahs. Also, again, for those of you who are new, I like to find the relevance for us in the Torahs and for myself personally, not just preaching to you, in my life. And these last few weeks, I've had a lot of agonizing about how to behave with my family, given the current rules and the current changing rules of Corona and the prevalence of it. We have high risk in the family and we haven't been going out. And every week, I've been looking in this shiurim that I've been giving and I see there's ideas about planning and about Hashgacha, and I couldn't put my finger on it. All these weeks, I was like, so what's the message here? Is Hashem telling me that we should wait for later, or we shouldn't do it now? And I was like, trying to read into things, and then I put it aside. I said, forget it, what am I worrying about Hashgacha practice for? Let me just do my own logical, you know, strategizing. And we flushed it out and hashed it out. My husband and I spent like hours debating of what's safe and what's not safe, and what do we do, what do we not do? And we made our decisions, right? Like Esther made her decisions. And after a certain point, Hashem said, okay, now I'll make the decision for you. And sure enough, my husband and my family have Corona. Baruch Hashem, everyone's fine. And now it's decided, and now it's safe. We can send our kids back to school. Thank you, Hashem. And like, the past has just been settled. As much, we went crazy strategizing and planning and being logical. And after a certain point, we just let go. And Hashem said, okay, I'm going to send you a scenario right now. And now it's all going to become clear to you what you have to do. And this is what's going on in our lives, is we plan and we try to figure out, and ultimately we say, okay, Hashem, when's the moment? When are you going to show us? We have to ask Hashem. Of course, at your daven, the Amishol daven, we have to daven and ask him to get involved. But after a certain point, we can only plan so much. And then it's up to Hashem. So she did this, and Hashem, you know, she felt it. It wasn't the right moment. She'll do another party tomorrow. Hopefully it'll be better after the fast. So Haman, of course, he doesn't know any about this, and he leaves the party, and he says, Meach v'tov leave. And the question is, why do we have these two phrases? He's happy, and he's good of heart. He's, like, in a good mood. What do we need both phrases for? What does it tell us? And we'll finish. The pasuk of the chirot, Haman et Mordechai b'shar ha-melech, v'lo kam v'lo z'avimenu, v'imoy Haman al Mordechai chema. So first, Haman's all happy. He's in the best mood, everything is great. He feels so important. The queen and the king, they had a private party. It's just him. He has a very important position, right? Until he sees Mordechai. Mordechai is sitting at the Shachar Melech, and he's not budging. He's not bowing, he's not doing anything. And Haman is incensed. He is so mad at Mordechai, and suddenly his entire mood changes. And the short lesson of this pasuk, I would say, is pretty straightforward, right? Haman had everything. We're going to see later on how he brags to his family soon, and he has a big family, he has an important position, he has a private, you know, audience with the king and queen, he has everything. And yet, as soon as there's one thorn in his side, there's one issue, one thing that's a problem for him, that doesn't, person that doesn't show him honor, he loses it. He loses everything. And again, we'll see, we'll scroll ahead a little bit. In Pasuk Gimel, we say, V'chol zeh einenu shavali, V'chol yed asher ani ro'et Mordechai Yehud Yoshev v'shah ha-melech. All of these things, you know, let's do the pshat. In between, he's all happy. He says Mordechai gets mad. He holds back until he gets home. And then he sends for his wife. He sends for his loved ones. He starts talking to them and venting to them. He talks to them about he is rich and he has a family and he has this important position. I also provide the audience with the king and the queen, and also tomorrow, but it's worth nothing. And again, the pshat here is, anyone want to say pshat? Of course not. Everyone's embarrassed on Zoom, that's okay. But the pshat is, it's a certain perspective, a certain mahalach in life that he has. It's a self-oriented, selfish, opposite of sameach b'chalko perspective of life, where everything could be great, you could have all the brachas in the world, but you just notice the one problem. Right? Sometimes kids are like this, especially, and certain personalities of people are like this, where they can have all the brachas in the world, there's one issue, and they're the most angry person in the world. It's as if they don't have anything else. It's not worth anything. You could have all the brachas if you focus on the negative, of course, then all you're going to see is the negative. And of course, the response to this is to be sameach b'chalko, and to notice our blessings, and to appreciate our blessings, and to not let the one bad thing get to us. You know, if we have experienced a lot of good things, Ellen, we were just talking about this, how Hashem, whatever, personal situation, where I was saying that after I'd be upset, Hashem blesses us with so many things, right? This is how we have to view life, is look at the good, and not to let the one bad thing bother us, to be able to focus on the good. Because this is a shot. Let's just go back to Pasuk Tet from it. Okay, the Alshech has a really interesting analysis of Pasuk Tet. He says, watch for the two phrases on math, the 12 leaves. And he says, Haman, if you think of the Pasuk logically, let's take a step back from the story for a minute. We know the story too well. So let's take a step back and imagine if we never heard before. Okay? Esther has her plan, right? And she invites Haman and the king to a party. So she comes unannounced to the king. She tells the king the plan, and then Haman gets invited too, and they're all this party. If Haman had his head on straight, something should have bothered him. Something is wrong with this picture. Imagine you're Haman at the party. What's wrong? Again, I invite you to unmute your microphones. I don't know if anybody's brave enough. It's okay. If you have stuff going on in the background, in your house, it's not only if you're not brave. But anyway, anyone take a shot?
She invited her husband. I mean, what's Haman doing there?
Okay, so first of all, he should have noticed that something was weird. Instead of getting all caught up, look, they invited me, he should have been like, hold on, why'd they invite me? Great.
Anything else? It's a little odd.
Well, he was the top prime minister, so like, on one hand it's odd, on the other hand, he could have rationalized it to himself. But that's definitely a good point. Anything else? It should have jumped out at him. So let's replay the scenario, right? Achashverosh knew there must be something important that she wants to request, because he saw she came in unannounced, when that's against the law. She risked her life. So he says to her at the party, what's your request? So here's Haman sitting at the party. He's like, they invited me to the party. Look at this. It's a nice honor. I'm the prime minister. I'm important. Right? And then Achashverosh is like, so Esther, what did you want to ask me? So Haman should have said, what does he mean? What did you want to ask me? Did Esther make this party with a particular strategy, with a particular ulterior motive here? Like, what's this party about? Why is he asking her, what do you want to ask me? That should have bothered Haman. And then, Haman's a smart guy. Something else Haman might have noticed. Remember our timetable here. Right? It's the third day of the fast. What just happened at the beginning of the fast, before the fast? Haman had just sent out the gazela. He just sent out the law, the decree, that Am Yisrael should be destroyed. Boom, barely any time passes, and suddenly the queen is inviting him and the king to a private party, and the king is like, so, Queen Esther, what do you want to ask me? If Haman had been thinking strategically and, you know, with his head on straight, with his smarts, he could have noticed, wait a second, why'd they invite me? Why'd the king ask for this question? Why did this happen right after the gezeiras I sent out? Hold on a minute. Says the Alshech, Haman should have figured out, he should have been suspicious, what if Esther's Jewish? Maybe he realized also, she has this correspondence with Mordechai, like Mordechai's the leader of the Jews, you know? Something's out here. Haman should have said, hold on a second. Maybe Esther's Jewish. Maybe it's not a coincidence that this party was right after the gezeirah. Maybe there's a request that the queen wants to make from the king. And then Esther pushes him off. And it's like, come to another party tomorrow. Also with Haman. Haman should be like, heh, what am I doing here? What is she up to? What does she have? She has something against me? She's trying to topple me? She's trying to topple my gezeirah? Maybe. What's going on? And this could have been and would have been logical for Esther to do, for Haman to realize, if he'd been thinking about it. But he wasn't thinking about it. Says Alshe, he was on the Tovlev, everything was fine, he was on his high horse, figuratively, right? The next day he's not going to get his high horse, he's going to be below the horse. But he was had all the power, he had everything, right? So how he was, you know, full of nice food and wine, so he was the Tovlev. He got all caught up in himself. Says the Alshech, there are two ingredients at play here. What caused him to overlook this strange thing going on? Number one, Hashgacha Pratis. This is Hashem hidden in the Megillah right here. Hashgacha Pratis was, Haman didn't pick up on these things. He didn't notice, he didn't care, he didn't realize, it didn't bother him. And so he didn't care, he came to the party the next day without a problem, right? If he had realized, then maybe he wouldn't have come to the party the next day. Or maybe he would have tried to talk to Ahasuerus later that day to convince him something to kind of separate Esther from him or do something to prevent Esther from doing what she did, right? From revealing him and stopping Gezeirah. But he didn't realize. So number one is Hashgacha Pratis. Number two says, Alshe, Hashgacha Pratis here wasn't out of nowhere. Because Chazal say that a Rasha is Birashut Libam. This is what Rashaim are. They're like in the field of their own heart. Like all they care about is their own dealings. They're in their own mind, in their own world, in their own cares. And this is the nature of a Rasha. And so, instead of looking outwards and noticing cues around him, he was focusing inwards in a guided kind of way. And he was thinking about himself. And because he was so focused on himself in a guided kind of way, therefore Hashgacha Pratis had space to swoop in and to keep him that way. And he stayed that way, and he didn't pick up on it, and then everything was able to proceed to the next step, so that ultimately the Gezeirah could be toppled. And I want to contrast this with what we know about Esther and what we said before about her strategizing. Okay? Of course, Hashgacha Pratis piece is there for both. This is, of course, the Purim story we're talking about. But Esther took it upon herself to notice all the details. She noticed the details about, again, if you weren't with us, little recap, she noticed the details to send the messenger to Mordechai to find out more information, who is the most trusted officer, who would be the best choice of a person to be the go-between. She strategized about what would make Ahasuerus in the best mood to more likely accept her words and listen to what she has to say. She wanted to put in a position where Haman would be there so that he would be able to stumble quickly if they said something. He would be there right away for Ahasuerus to capture him, as we know is what happened, to be killed. Right? She thought about all the details and the subtleties of the situation in order to be the messenger of Hashem, to be the Yeshua, to bring the Yeshua for Bnei Yisrael. Whereas Haman was the opposite. Haman was so caught up in himself, he did not notice subtleties, he did not notice what was going around him, and he was not thinking strategically in this way. So, of course, lesson for us from Esther, as opposed to Haman, is to think about what's going on around us, right? Notice inconsistencies. Notice, and this applies in so many different realms, right? If you see someone acting, Chash V'Shalom, I don't know, the person that came to mind is like in Israel, you see someone acting strangely, right? Chash V'Shalom is suspicious, Chavit Chashu, like things that are off. It's extremely important, of course, for public safety, to notice things that are a little bit off. But also with people around us, right? If some, in the positive, if a family member looks a little bit off, something's bothering them, don't just let it be. Ask them how they're doing, or a friend, right? You haven't heard from someone in a while who usually you're in touch with a lot. Especially also, speaking of Corona, people who are home more. This was said in the news at different points along the way, where if you haven't heard from someone and they're home, let's say they had a risk or something, or they just haven't been around, be in touch with them. Maybe they're depressed. Maybe something is wrong, right? Reach out to people. Notice things that don't make sense with each other. And this is the way we have to view the world. It reminds me of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? The Sneh, when one of the godless, why was Moshe so great that he was able to be the one that this burning bush appeared to? Maybe he was the first person who noticed it or stepped aside to do anything about it. Part of the godless of our leaders is that they look around them. They don't stare at their cell phones. you know, all day long without being aware of their surroundings, that they're sensitive and they pay attention and they listen and they do something about it. It's the lesson of Esther and the anti-lesson, we could say, of Haman here. Okay, so we have the story. Mordechai here, he leaves the party. Mordechai is lo kam velo za, which is just interesting to compare to how previously when he didn't bow down, it said that he wouldn't bow down. Similarly, here, lo kam velo za, there he didn't bow, here he didn't budge. And the Mefarshim say that it was a little bit different relationship here with Haman than what he had at the beginning. At the beginning, it was a religious reason why he wouldn't bow down. Maybe Haman had a tzelem, he viewed himself as a god, and he wasn't allowed to bow down. And so, because it was a religious principle that prevented Mordechai from bowing down, so Haman realized this, and he got mad at Mordechai, but really got mad at all the Jews. He declared that all of them should be killed. Here already, it's a personal matter a little bit more. Mordechai wouldn't budge. He wouldn't even give him human respect of an important person. Okay, Ruth Malaral, who says that he didn't budge because he didn't even want to give him any respect. The whole time he didn't want to, but now the Hashgacha Pratis that Mordechai was starting to see in the story was allowing him to be more courageous and bold in his behavior. Whereas previously he did what he had to do to keep the Torah properly, but here he saw already, first he saw that Esther was being favored and heading to the palace. This was years before, but we had said also previously that this was already, Mordechai saw something's going on here, let me keep an eye on the situation. Hashem is doing things that are a little unusual, that Esther's getting special treatment, right? Then he saw how she's in the palace when this favor is being sent out, and she's in a position to affect things, right? He sees that slowly but surely Hashem is in the story here. And he said, you know what? I don't have to even tip my hat to him. I don't have to do anything to him because Hashem is on our side. Hashem's going to save us. And he developed in his courage not to respond to Haman even on a lower level. And he didn't even budge for him. And so accordingly, v'yomlei Haman al Mordechai chema. So now Haman, he's not mad at Am Yisrael about this. He's just mad at Mordechai for this because it's Mordechai's personal relationship with him and personal gesture towards him. And this is this interaction over here. So, we said Haman held back until he got home. Finally, he got home. He couldn't hold back anymore. And so he really, let it out to Zeresh and to his loved ones. Here we're going to turn to the Midrash. We're doing a lot of Midrashim in this year. And we have, Gemara over here. Vayisver lehem Haman ekvod ashrov rov banav. Okay, he told about all these things that he has to his family, and it describes him as having a lot of children. V'chamar of banav. So how many children does he have? What does it mean, a lot? Amar Rav Shloshim. Asara Metu, Vasara Nitlu, Vasara Machazin Al Tachim. 10 of them, he had 30 sons actually. He didn't just have 10 sons that we know about. He actually had 30 sons. 10 of them actually died previously, before the whole story happened, in childhood presumably. 10 of them were the ones that were hanged. And the other 10, ended up being forced to beg from door to door, people's doors. The Rabbanan Amri, Otan Shemachziran Al-Ptachim Shivim. Some of the rabbis said, actually, those 10 that went from door to door, they ended up as beggars, actually there were 70 of them. I have a little wordplay here, Sveim Balacham Nisharu, Al-Tikrei Sveim Elas Shivim. A pasuk about people who became poor, that they actually relate to the number 70. There were 70 of them. The Rami Bar Abba Amar, one more opinion. Kulam Matayim Ushmona. Actually, there were 208 children of Haman. What does that mean? Shneamar Barov Banav. Why? Because the pasuk says Rov Banav, his many children. Barov B'Gematria Matayim the Arvesar Havu. Actually, it's 208 is the Gematria Barov Amar Avnachem Bar Yitzchak Barov Ktiv. It's because it's without the Vav. That's why it ends up as 208. Because that's the gematria of the word Verov. So the little Maharal, last time we became introduced to Maharal's number perspective on numbers and number plays and understanding of these wacky numbers in the Agadah of the Gemara. And here he explains to us as well, not as having specific symbolism for a specific allusion or association, but rather that the numbers signify certain things. He says, whereas number one is a single point in space, it's an individual item, the number two represents that there exists another dimension to something, or another extension of something. Number three already means there's a lot. It's more than just two. It's more than just a multiple number that's more than one, but it's an additional one. It's three. Three means many. However, because when you're talking about children, three doesn't really mean many, because many people have three children. Therefore, it must be 3 times 10, says Maharal. It must be in the next unit level up of 10. So it must be 30 is the significant number that signifies many when it comes to children. Another perspective in the Gemara, according to Maharal's understanding, is 70. There are psukim where the number 7 is actually significant, and it symbolizes also a multiplicity of something. In the Tocha, it says, "B'derach echad yatsu, uv'sheva drachim yanusu." They'll come out in one way, and they'll run away in 7 different ways, meaning 7 implies a multiplicity, a multitude, more, a lot more, than just the one path at the beginning. And so 7, once again, signifies many, and also with children, it signifies many, but Maharal says, really, also let's bump it up a notch to the tens units to really imply a lot, a lot, a lot. And finally, the 208 is a gematria, but not just of the rov, says Maharal. 208 also is gematria of revu, as in peru u revu, which, again, is talking about having lots and lots of children. And so the point of the Gemara, according to Maharal, in invoking all these numbers, is that the pasuk, in describing the grand wealth and multitude in Haman's family, is trying to describe just that. The numbers of the Gemara just enhance the numbers, the description, actually, of the psukim. They try to make it sound even more. In other words, the psukim say he had a lot, and the Gemara says he had a lot, a lot, indicated by these numbers. Actually, the Maharal says more. He says that even the name Haman actually is related to the word for multitude, hamon, a lot of something. And so there's an aspect of Haman, from his perspective, and from the initial stages of his life, really initial, I'm calling it initial, till the end of his life, really, my recording ended over here, my phone, as having to do with multitude, that he felt like he had a lot. He accomplished so much. Even his name indicates so much. Haman, Haman, he had so many children, he had all this wealth, right? And ultimately, in the end, Hashem is in charge, and Hashem took it all away. And so this is what's indicated by this, we were talking about numbers as multitude, but really, what is the 70? The 70 wasn't describing the multitude of children. The 70 was describing how many of the children ended up as beggars. So says Maharal, in the end, we see from the story that the one, Haman, who felt that he was the one with much, 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 Haman, 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 in the end, he ended up having less and less and less, and it was all taken away from him. And we see this by the Gemara's description of his sons as beggars, where the three things that happened, actually. What are the three things that happened to his sons? Some of them died in childhood, some of them ended up being hanged, and some of them were beggars. And so the Maharal says, this is three different versions of how someone's wealth and multitude could be taken away from them. The ones who died indicate a natural kind of situation where something great is taken away from someone. In life, people die. It seems like they died of childhood illnesses or something. And the ones who were hanged, this is an unnatural death, where they were actively hanged and punished and killed. And so someone who has a lot, things can be taken away in an unnatural way as well. Finally, the third situation of them becoming beggars is kind of both, he says, where on one hand, someone could gain have more parnassah and they could have less parnassah. So it's kind of the way of the world. On the other hand, a whole group of people having to become beggars, losing their wealth to such a degree that they're poor and going from door to door, is also unnatural. So he says sometimes losing things, and Haman's losing things, can happen also in kind of a mixed kind of way. So we have Haman, through his sons, is described as the one who seemed to have it all, and then in the end, he was really the one who lost it all. This is a description of Verov Vanov in his peak of bragging about his greatness. The Gemara highlight how this actually indicated his low state and what was going to be lost. So this is the description of his wealth. Now we have, back to the passage for a minute. So we have his great wealth, and he goes to everybody, and he brings especially his wife and his loved ones, and he told everybody about what happened, and he said, V'chol ze'inan shaveli. And then we have the last pasuk of the parak, V'tomer lo zera shishto, v'chol ha'vav yasu eitz gavah, hamishim amah, v'boker amor lamelech, v'yitlu et mordechai alav, uvoy lamelech el hamishah sameach, v'yitav advar lefnei haman v'yasa eitz. So they come with this recommendation, especially Zeresh, and his loved ones, some consensus of a decision. They say, make these wooden gallows tree, 50 amos high in the morning, You should tell the king to hang Mordechai on this. And something about this description made him very, very happy. He figured that this really solved his problem. Let's get rid of the thorn in my side. Let's get rid of Mordechai. And he was able to go forward for the party the next day to end that day feeling, you know, well, it wasn't really over. We'll see the next characters in the nighttime. But he was able to end that moment, that kind of poof of time, where he was disturbed with a satisfying thought, Vayas Ha'et. So then we have a long midrash here talking about this Vayas Ha'et. It says, Vaitava Zavar Lefnei Haman Vayas Ha'et. This is midrash Rabbah. We've been doing a lot of midrash Rabbah in this year. And this is a long midrash. I'm going to go through most of it quickly. You'll see why in a moment. But as we're going through it, I want you to think about it and see if it makes you think of anything. Midrash word association, okay, or description association, and see where this midrash takes us. Because again, for those of you who haven't joined us before, we've been viewing midrash in interesting ways. Sometimes it enhances the pshat, but many times it's also very symbolic. The Rambam says how we're supposed to view midrash as teaching a lesson and not necessarily that this is exactly what happened in real life. And so we try to view the midrash in ways that can teach us something that we can learn about that are relevant for us. So let's see what's happening here. Tell us about this eitz. Oh, midrash. Says the midrash, what kind of tree was this? Amr chachamim. And again, those who've been in the shir before may have certain midrash associations, and those who haven't may have different associations. And I would love it if anyone has a noisy background and can't open their, microphone, if you want to write in the chat, if you have any thoughts. Oh, I see, I wasn't even looking in the chat before. Hold on a second. Okay. So everyone can join the chat. I'm not going to go back to the topic now, but you can look at it. From before, and if you have any word associations, thought, you know, topic associations along the way, feel free to write it in the chat. Okay, so what kind of tree was this, and what is it, why do we care? Let's see from the midrash. Okay, again, I'm going to go through this a little bit quickly because it's a little bit fast. The Amru Chachamim b'Sha'as Shebalach, you know, what really happened when Haman was preparing, he was going to start preparing this tree, these wooden gallows. Kara HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'chol Atzei Breishit. Hashem called all the trees of creation together. Mi tein v'yitalah Rasha Zelav. Who's going to give themselves, who's going to come forward that this Rasha should be hanged upon him? Which tree is it going to be? Te'ena Amra. Anina Te'ena, that's me. So the fig tree came up. I'll give myself first. I mean, many me v'in Yisrael Bikurim, because Bikurim were brought to me. V'la'od. Elisha Nimshli Yisrael Kivikura. Also B'nai Yisrael is compared to me. Hadu Dikhtiv Kivikura B'teina B'reishita. And for those who are not familiar with the style of Medrash, a lot of times the Midrash says certain things, and then it brings psukim from all over Tanakh to back it up. So there are a lot of significant psukim here, as we're going to go through the narrative of the different trees presenting themselves before Hashem. And each tree has a pasuk to back itself up. As an aside, I don't know if I didn't compare the actual psukim. I'm guessing my kids' school may have gotten their Tu B'Shvat activity a year ago from this Midrash. They have a beautiful curriculum last year's Tu B'Shvat where they talked about a lot of different psukim where Am Yisrael is compared to many different trees. And it's a whole Tu B'Shvat lesson that we're not going to do tonight to examine what is the symbolism and significance of each of these fruits. And it's a beautiful activity for Tu B'Shvat to think about the symbolism of each separate tree and each separate fruit and what they're relevant to. But for now, we're going to read through them. Gefen Amra Ani Eitena, that's me, Shavi Nimshli Yisrael, also B'nai Yisrael is compared to a grapevine, Hazo Dechtiv Gefen Mimitsharim Tessiyah. Rimon Amar Ani Eitena, that's me, Shavi Nimshli Yisrael, also we're compared to a pomegranate, Shanemar, Kefel Acharimon Rakatech, Egoz Amar Ani Eitena, that's me, Shavi Nizmu Yisrael, also to nuts, in Shira Shirim, Hazo Dechtiv, Elgi Nats Egoz Yerodati, Etrog Amar Ani Eitena, that's me, Shemi Meni Lim Yisrael, the mitzvah. We're not only compared to B'nai Yisrael, but also use us for a mitzvah, says the Eshrim tree. We're part of the mitzvah, and the nation is compared to us as Hadas. Shemar, who omid bin Hadasim Asher Bamtsula. Zayit Amar comes to olive tree. Ani etena nat misha dinim shul Yisrael, also compared to olive trees. Shemar is Zayit Ranan Yefei Pritor Kara Hashem Shmich. Tapuach Amar ani etena nat misha dinim shul Yisrael. Shemar ki tapuach batei ayar kein dadi bin abanim. The apple tree uchtiv reach apech the tapuchim. Also another pasuk for the apple tree. Dekel Amar, palm trees come. What do they say? Ani etena nat misha dinim shul Yisrael. Zayit dechtiv in shir Hashem. Zok kol matech dam talat Amar. Ase shitim vase broshim amru anu nitein asmenu shem menu nasa hamishkan v'nevnei hamikdash, right? The shitim trees and the brush trees, the acacia trees and the tall trees, what are they called? Cypress trees, I think they're in English, right? We were used to build the mishkan, the base of mikdash. You should choose us. All these trees have such tachuyos, right? Eretz v'tamar amru az nitein asmenu shem nimshalim v'tzadik shem amar tzadik katamari frach ke'erez galvan on yiskeh. Now we have the comparison to Tzadik. Arava Amra Ani Atena Atzmi Shabinim Shli Yisrael Shneimar Karavim Al Yivlei Maim Menno Lim LeMitzvah Arba Minim Shabalulav Uv Otar Asha'a. Now we take a deep breath and pause. Okay, we have all these beautiful trees, the beautiful imagery of them all presenting themselves one by one. Hashem, look at me. I have such a clear associated with me. Choose me for getting rid of this Russia, for saving Am Yisrael. Suddenly, there's a little voice in the back of the crowd. Amar HaKotz, Lesnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Some kind of thorn tree pipes up from the back in front of Hashem. And what does he say? Ribono Shel Olam, Ani, She'ein Yomal Litlot, Atein that's me. Vitalet Hameze, Shani Nikresh Mikotz, Vuhu Kotz Machiv. Says a thorn tree, some kind of thorny, not fruitful, not compared to Bnei Yisrael, not used for a mitzvah. This bare, prickly tree says, Hashem, maybe you'd like to choose me. I don't have anything to hang myself on. No pun intended, right? Ainli Bame or Alma Litzlot. I have nothing to hang myself on. So instead, hang something on me. I'm nothing. I'm bare. Hang someone bare on me. Someone tell me on me. Perfect match. I'm like a nothing. I don't have too much to offer. So hang him on me. Shani Nikrash Mi Kotz. I'm called a thorny tree. And he's like a thorny guy. Right? He's painful to Am Yisrael. V'na'a she'itala Kotz al Kotz. It's an appropriate match. U'mimenu Masu Vaso. So, that's what they made the tree from. Okay? And then we have a interesting ending here. V'kevan shev'yu l'fanav hechino al petach beito u'madar atzmo alav l'harot avadav he'achi tala Mordechai alav. Then Haman did this really smart thing. Right? He got his thorn tree wood. And he stood up in front of it and like measured himself against it. And he's like, here, this is the way you should hang Mordechai. Right? It seems very Einhar-esque. Heshiva, so Bakal came out and says, Na'elachai, look at that, the tree fits you perfectly, Haman. Right? Mitzukan l'cha'et, misheshi ime, breshit. This tree has been waiting for you since the 6 days of creation. And I think it's also interesting that, this tree, it could sound like two different points of the Midrash. Where, on one hand, you know, the first part is talking about all the trees, and the second part is talking about what Mordechai did, or you could think of the two parts as connected to each other, right? After the coach tree came forward and presented himself, then it talks about how Mordechai, how Haman, you know, dealt with the tree, and then the Bakal says, this tree has been waiting for you, Haman, since Sheish Shmei Breishis. Any thoughts on this midrash? Anybody want to share anything? Word association, midrash association, message association, symbolism perhaps? Chat? Unmute? No? Okay. I'll tell you the truth. The first thing that came to mind, and maybe you're thinking this and didn't want to say it, I don't know. The first thing that came to mind when I heard this midrash was last week's parsha. Last week's parsha, Parsha Yitro, we have Har Sinai, right? The famous children's story kind of midrash. It's in, there's multiple children's books written about it. Songs written about it, right? All the mountains came forward when Hashem was going to give the Torah. This is Lahafrach. This is the first interesting thing, right? Here we have a negative job. It was important, but it was negative. And now, of course, we have the most positive thing, a mountain the Torah should be given on. And all the trees are saying, me, me, they're all lining up, just like the trees, right? All the mountains are saying, give the Torah on me, and they're all giving these reasons. I'm the tallest, I'm the biggest, right? And, in fact, what happened? None of the ones that came forward claiming why they should be chosen were actually chosen. And instead, we have someone else. We have a little underdog. It's an underdog story. How nice, right? The underdog, the little guy, the little mountain, the little bare tree, that's the one that gets chosen. So on one hand, you could view it as the same lesson. Maybe that midrash, everyone knows there's a midrash teach about humility, right? The other mountains were bragging, and this mountain was humble, and that was the one that was chosen, right? Maybe this midrash is a lesson about humility. I'm not so sure if that's true. Could be. I'm thinking, when there's something different. What's different? There's a few things that are different. What's different between the mountain story and the tree story? Okay? I think in the mountain story, first of all, the other mountains are actively negative, right? They're bragging, I'm the tallest, I'm the beautiful, most beautiful, right? That's why you should pick me. And so they're clear symbols of gaiva, and Har Sinai is a clear symbol of another of humility. Here, the other trees are not necessarily being tzaddik, right? They didn't do something wrong. What did they say wrong? I'm not seen for this. Why? It's okay sometimes to say, maybe I'm right for this job, right? We talked about that also a different week, that all the shomrim, all the guards and Ahasuerus' palace were passing along the buck. It's not their responsibility. No, we should say what's our responsibility. Maybe it is the right match for this tree. It's trees, these ferments of this tree is connected to Am Yisrael, so they should be used to save Am Yisrael. So I wouldn't assume that this is teaching the lesson not to be Gavdik, because I don't know if those trees were Gavdik. Maybe they were just presenting their case, right? And what did happen, though? What happened is the coach tree. I think the coach tree is even more subtle of a message than Har Sinai. It's not just humility. Because Har Sinai was small. Very nice. It teaches about smallness, right? And it didn't have a lot to offer, and it also didn't brag, right? The coach tree did offer himself. He didn't say, don't pick me, and Hashem said, oh, pick him. It's different. I was considering bringing, like, the text of the mountain midrash, but I didn't want to get into other midrashim from other topics and get all caught up in the nitty-gritty of other topics so much, so I'm just referring to it. But with the coach tree, I think what's so interesting is that the tree, it doesn't say, don't pick me. He says, pick me. But why? It's a humble reason. It's a reason that might otherwise be considered a lack. The coach tree had nothing to offer. In fact, it might be viewed negatively because it's thorny. It says, I'm called thorny and this guy is called thorny. It's a match. Hang the thorny guy on the thorny tree. Right? He doesn't think he is beautiful. He doesn't think he's delicious and nice smelling and connected to Am Yisrael and for mitzvahs. He sees that he has something that could be interpreted as negative. But he doesn't view it as negative. He says, oh, there's something that's matim for me, and I'm matim for something. There's something that's a match. This is my moment. This is my time. And in fact, I think they are connected. The second half of the Midrash about Haman standing there with the noose and the Midrash Bakul saying, this has been for you. This tree is matim for you from the Sheishi Shmei Breishis. What does that mean? Pirkei Avos teaches us the Ein Lo, I'm going to forgive me if I misquote it. I don't have it in front of me. Ein Lo Davar She'ein Lo Sha'ah, something to that effect, right? There's nothing that doesn't have its hour. Every single thing in the world has its place and time and moment to shine. Even a thorny tree. And maybe some people might have viewed this thorny tree as daka lacking. It doesn't have fruits, it doesn't have smell, it's not compared to Am Yisrael anywhere, it's not even comfortable to be around, right? There's nothing good about it. But the tree knew better. The tree knew that it was meant for some day and some time and some job. And when it heard that job along coming around, it said, that's it. That's my moment. I'm going to show up and I'm going to volunteer because I knew there was something all along from Jesus May Gracious. There was something waiting for it. And every person is like that. And everything in the world is like that. And we should never look at something and think that something looks completely unpleasant and completely negative and completely harmful and it doesn't have a job. It doesn't have a position because everything has a job and everything has a position. And there are sometimes also circumstances in people's lives where people might view it as a disadvantage and view it as a negative or a challenge, a test, a harsh, bad thing, right? And in certain senses, many things that are hard in life certainly can be understood that way, understandably so. But if we look at it as destined for a job, then it's not like that. And just, I don't want to give examples that might be interpreted to say that I'm saying those things are bad, but I'm saying it in the sense of some people might feel that they have a bad lot, right? Let's say someone who's single for a very long time, right? Might feel like a coach, they don't have a match, they don't have a comparison, a full life. However, what some might view as a lack is also an opportunity. When someone's single, they have more opportunities, they're more available to do certain mitzvahs and certain chesed and certain things or studies or whatever it is they spend their time and other people may not be available to do. And so to view a challenge as an opportunity or as even as a chus in that moment in life, it could be at the same time as it's a challenge, right? He didn't deny that he was a thorn. He said, I'm called a thorn, I know. But there's something that's a match for me. I have a job that I can do with this thorn, right? Someone has a certain situation that's challenging, what redeeming value can we find in it? What opportunity can we find in that? Maybe there didn't even exist when I had the blessings that I wanted in my life, right? And I think this is the lesson of the coach. It's a lot more subtle, I think, than the mountains. And I think it really can teach us a perspective on life and on how we view ourselves and how we view things. Okay. What time is it? Okay. So we have our treats. Let's continue. I'm going to go back to the Midrash now. Okay? We're going to scroll down a bit. Further point in the Midrash. Okay, Dalet in this section called Dalet in Esther Rabba. La'achar she'atai. So after Haman made this tree, Halach ate from Mordechai. He went back to Mordechai, which is an interesting thing in and of itself. U'mitza'o shehaya yoshed b'beit ha-midrash. And he saw Mordechai was sitting in the beis midrash, v'atinoko yoshen l'fanav. Now, at first when I saw this midrash, I shied away from it. I was like, no way I'm talking about the midrash. It's too horrible. It's too scary. It was very disturbing to me. But then I decided, dafka, because it's disturbing, I think it's important to share. What was having beis midrash? Mordechai wasn't sitting wrapped in his cloak in a meditative state by himself in another world, asking Hashem to save the nation. He was sitting with all the kids. We don't know how old the kids are. Tinokol Shabbat Rabban is an expression that's used by Chachamim many times. It's some age of kids. And they were sitting, and they were wearing sackcloth too. Yisakim v'manehem v'oskim b'Torah. They were dressed in sackcloth, and they were all learning Torah with Mordechai. Mordechai, apparently, was not a Gadol Hador who was sitting in an ivory tower. He was sitting with the people, and not just any people. He was sitting with the kids. And you may remember that there was a midrash where Mordechai went to the kids to find his Hashgacha Pratis. Right? After the Gezerah went out, he went out to the kids. He had a kesher. He had a connection to the kids who were in school. And he felt Hashem involved through the Tzvikim that they were learning at that time. And so he felt that they were a very important part of the process of how this Gezerah was going to unfold. And so he brought them to him. He sat with them. I don't know who brought who to who. And so he was sitting learning with them, all in sackcloth. These kids were crying and they were screaming. Umana utam, umatsasham. Haman looked there and he counted. I don't know how he counted this much. He estimated or counted. He found that there were 22,000 tinoko. We're not going to darshan this number in particular. There were tons and tons. This is not a little classroom. This was like a lecture hall full of kids. Imagine the scene. Again, many times we interpret midrash as symbolic. Here, it's not like a picturesque kind of midrash that maybe there's symbolism here too, but I view it as more kind of elaborating on the scenario of what was going on, right? Imagine the scene of a huge lecture hall, based imagine 22,000 kids all dressed in mourning clothes, crying and screaming, very intense scene. He shlich aleihem shal shal ot shal barza. Haman, I don't know how he had this much chains, but in some way, he put iron chains on these kids. This huge group of kids, he tied them all up. These kidalim shomrim, and he set up guards in this huge base medrash full of kids. Yamar, lemachar eherog elu atinoko tchila. Tomorrow I'm going to kill these kids first. And if you remember the midrash, when Mordechai went to the kids in the first place, asked the psukim they were learning, and saw Hashgacha Pratis, and the psukim they said that Hashem was going to be with them, also then Haman said, I'm going to get those kids first. And we see here, it's not even anywhere near Adar yet. They just sent out the Gezerah, and Haman's like, I'm not waiting for this Gezerah. I don't care. I said I was going to kill the kids first. I'm going to kill the kids first. He couldn't stand the sight of it. And so he put them in this horrible state. Again, this is why I didn't want to even share them. They're just like too horrible to imagine. But I think it really highlights for us the horrendous picture of what was going on. And their parents got word of what was going on. The mothers started coming to this huge beish medrash and they were bringing food to their kids. They said, eat, drink, don't die of hunger or starving. At least you should die with a full belly. What did these kids do? They put their hands in the sifarim. They swore in the name of their master Mordechai. They said, no. We're going to die at fasting. We are doing tshuva on behalf of Klal Yisrael. I'm in a terrible state. Can you imagine kids feeling the relevance of a national, like in our day and age, no one even tells the kids of such a thing. We would protect them. Why should you tell kids a horrible thing? Make them scared. I can't imagine this, right? Completely different reality. Where Dafka the kids knew. Dafka the kids were pure-hearted, caring, understanding on the level where they were most nefesh to daven and fast and be in sackcloth and be in this horrible state. And they said, no, we don't want to be comfortable. We want to do tshuva. We want to save Am Yisrael. We want to be fasting. We're going to die out of the fasting. Go kulam b'vchia ach al tasha batam l'barom. And this picture, on one hand, we view it as horrible in our day and age. On the other hand, according to the Midrash, this is what pierced the heavens. Their cries went straight up to Shamayim v'shamaka, Shabaruchu kol b'chiatam, k'shevishvei shau b'layla. In the middle of that night, that fateful night in between the two parties, this is what was going on. says the Midrash. And their cries pierced the heavens in the middle of the night, 2 hours into the night, Be'otash anit galgulu rachamav shal kadosh baruch hu, v'yamad mikisei din v'yashav v'kisei rachamim. Hashem couldn't ignore the cries of these children and the suffering of these children, and he moved from the kisei din to the kisei rachamim. Amar ma kol gadol zeshani shomea b'gidayim v'tolayim. Sound was like sheep and goats baying. What is the sound? Amar Moshe Rabbeinu v'nei kadosh baruch hu omer. What does he say? V'amar Bona Shalom, says Moshe Rabbeinu, Bogadahim, Velotulahim Him, Ela Kitane Amcha, Shehim Shruim Bitani Hayom, Shloshamim, Shloshalim. Don't ask me how the kids fasted 3 days and 3 nights. Again, I don't know quite how literal or not literal to interpret this Midrash, but I think it is something very, very powerful to tell us. The Kitane Amcha. Just look at that phrase, the Kitane Amcha. What are we doing with our Kitane Amcha? I'm talking to myself here. What am I doing with my Kitane Amcha? I've been stuck at home with them for the last 6 weeks, right? How could these Ketanim be like this? How are they raised? How are they taught? What effect do they have in Shemayim? Umacha rotza oyev l'shachtam kedayim k'lotzlayim, says Moshe Rabbeinu. The enemy wants to kill them tomorrow. It's not sheep and goats. He wants to kill them like sheep and goats. The tasha natal kadosh baruch hu, otan igrot shegazar lehem shayu chatumo v'chotan shaltit, referring to a previous midrash, Hashem took those gazeros, he tore them up, v'ipil achashverosh v'hala boto layla. That night, when Hashem moved from one seat to the other, that's the night when there was this massive upheaval of tshuva, of suffering, and Hashem switched from the kisei din to the kisei rachamim. Hadahu dechtiv, this is what it's talking about, the first pasuk of the next parak, balayla hahu nadadash nahamal. That's what it's talking about. Why was the king tossing and turning that night? What was going on? Something was going on. That night, it wasn't just that something was going on in the king's dreams. Hashgacha Pratis wasn't just in a bubble. We've been talking a lot about how Hashgacha Pratis works. What does that mean, Hashgacha Pratis? On one hand, you could view it as a bubble. On one hand, Esther fasted. She told everyone to fast. She was Moser Nefta. She went to the king. She had her strategy, right? The pieces of the human childless and Hashem came together so that Hashem would make Achashverosh not able to sleep that night and everything would proceed from there. But it was more than that. There was a lot more going down here on earth and a lot more going down up in Shemayim. And just as we've said in the past, we have no clue how Hashem works things in Shemayim. Sometimes we have no clue what's going on earth. We don't realize. We know what we're doing ourselves personally. We know what's going on in our circles, perhaps. We don't know what's going on the other end of the earth. When Hashem changes reality for people, it could be something we did. It could be something someone near us did. It could be something on the other end of the earth that people are doing. We don't know how much Moshe Nefesh people have. We don't know what effect on Shemayim it has. The world is so much bigger than our minds understand. So much bigger on earth and so much bigger in Shemayim. Debating, because this is a good place to end this year. On the other hand, we can go another few minutes and describe another midrash on a little different end of things. What's our timing like? What's our attention span like? I had a little more, okay. So there's another midrash, I'm not going to bring it inside. The midrash in the Yalkut Shimoni, which talks a little bit more about this beam that Haman shows. And it says this beam, it was 50 amos high. What kind of beam is 50 amos high? Says the Midrash. Midrash says this was not a stam beam. And I guess we could connect it to other things we're talking about, because just as we don't understand mitzad tahara, mitzad kedusha, what's going on in the world or Shemayim, we also don't understand what was on mitzad tumah and mitzad rishus. And this is what the other Midrash we're about to say is talking about. Says Midrash Yalkut Shimoni, where's he going to get a 50 amos beam from? It actually was from a particular place in a particular time. It was actually saved from the Teva of Noah. And in the Teva of Noach, we know that one of the dimensions was 50 amos, and there was one huge beam that was saved from the Teva, and somehow this beam was preserved, and Haman found it, and Haman was like, oh, this is my beam. I'm going to use it to hang Mordechai. And that was the telltale beam for hanging Mordechai. And says the Maharal, who cares? What are you talking about, Midrash? What does it have anything to do with Noach from? And who cares about the 50 amos long? And why does he still have it? Why does it exist anymore? Like, what's the Midrash trying to say? So Maharal explains, again, this is kind of understanding Mitzad Tumah, in a more of a mystical kind of sense. He says, every nace has some kind of residue that's left over in the world. We read about the mun recently in the Parsha, where there was some mun that was supposed to be preserved in a jar. It doesn't mean that it's kept for all generations that we know what happened to in the end, but at least initially it was supposed to be preserved in order to preserve the nace, so people should appreciate what happened. And so too with the Teva. After the Teva landed in Hararat, there was a beam, 150 Alma beam from the Teva, which was preserved as the remnant and the relic of this nace. Now, such a special relic wasn't lost too easily, and in fact it was known what beam it was, and in Parshas Noach, Unkelus translates Ararat, I don't even have the image in front of me, I'm sorry, it translates Ararat as a different terminology of a place, and the Midrash explains that this is the place that one of Haman's sons was actually in charge of this area of the world, this Azor. He was like a governor, and he was the governor in charge of this area of the world, Ararat, and so he had access to this beam. And in fact, there was something special about this beam and the number 50. What does it have to be? Why do we care that it was 50 almost tall? Why does the Pshat have to tell us that? What do we learn from it? And the answer, according to Maharal, is that 50, again, we talk about numbers, Maharal loves numbers, 50 is important, significant. We know that there's 49 Sha'arei Chachma. There's 49 gates of wisdom in the world, and the Chachamim say that Moshe Rabbeinu had access to the 49th level of wisdom, but the 50th level is considered Lamal Min HaTeva. People don't generally have access to the level of 50. And we say this Lara also, 49th level of Tuma, the 50th level is like beyond return, right? There's something about the number 49, 7 times 7, 7 days in a week, times 7 is 49, it's like the furthest we could get in this natural world, whereas 50 is like a Lamala, it's beyond, it's past what we could access. And so 50 Amos long of the Teva indicated that it was remnant, a relic of the Nes, of something Lamala and the Teva, of being saved from the flood. However, Haman had a different understanding of things. Even though we're saying people can reach 49th level, but Haman said, I can reach the 50th level. Haman, Midrash said, wore a tzelem on him. The Maharal explains further, Haman actually thought of himself as an avodah zarah. He thought of himself as a god, and so he felt that he was so powerful that he could reach the 50th level. He could be Lamal Menateva. So he said, I'm going to prove my mastery. This was Zeresh's plan that spoke and resonated with Haman, that Haman, if he's Lamal Menateva, he is a god, so of course it's only appropriate that he should show his rulership and power over Mordechai with something that's the number 50, because Mordechai was so powerful. He's the Tzadik Ador of Am Yisrael and the Jewish god, and we've spoken in the past about Achashverosh, and Haman had an appreciation, actually, of Hashem and Am Yisrael and who and what they are and the power of Hashem. And Haman said, no, I'm going to rival that. I'm also God, and I'm going to overpower Mordechai, and I'm going to show that I'm so great because I'm going to hang him on something that's a 50 that I have access to, that's a Lamal Menateva kind of thing. And so that's what he planned, and of course we know that this was completely false, and he was not able to do this, and in fact it showed the opposite, that he was the one who ended up being hanged on it, and he was not on this high level. He wanted to show another, on a simple level, it was so tall and high, would indicate that he was so powerful that he could overpower someone else who was very powerful. Haman, everyone knew Mordechai was the leader of the Jews. The Jews are supposed to be, you know, have this tradition of being in power. Now they're in exile, and Haman was trying to show, look who I conquered. I conquered this Mordechai, this great man. No, it's not him, it's me. And of course, he stood in front of that pole, and he measured himself. We said the Midrash that he measured himself against, and sure enough, the measurement was only him, Lara. It was only him for falling, for his downfall, and of course, ultimately, Hashem was pulling the strings and guiding the show, and we have Levin Hapuch. So with that, we ended our parak. With that, we will end the show.
Thank you so much.
Thoughts, comments, questions before we sign off?
That was amazing.
Baruch Hashem, thank you for joining us, everyone. Anyone who hasn't been to the show before, we have a WhatsApp group. When before it was on Zoom, we used to send out source sheets ahead of time, but if there's ever any change, and sometimes people have comments and thoughts that they want to share after the shiur, you're welcome to join the WhatsApp group. If you like, you can put your, let's see, shall we do this? How about, I'll put my WhatsApp number in the chat, and anybody who would like to be added to the WhatsApp group who's not on it can just private message me. Okay, let's do that.